Sports, this is Tony Rice, and with the memory of England's gallant World Cup efforts still fresh in those memory banks, and of course, Premier League football fans' appetite sated with the league kicking off last weekend, we're really lucky to be joined once again on the line by ITV's main football commentator, Clive Tildesley. Welcome back to Verum Sports, Clive.
It's good to be back. Thank you, Tony.
Hey, excellent stuff. And I've got to begin with your take on Russia 2018. 169 goals scored across 64 matches. That's not including penalty shootouts. It was one for the memory banks, I feel, this tournament.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure to be involved with the tournament and with the interest that it's quite literally excited in the country. It wasn't just the England games that were attracting massive television audiences. I think it's actually a little reminder to football that there is still a wide audience for free-to-air football on ITV or BBC or whatever. I think football's got to be a little bit careful in the way it's marginalising its product at the moment, and everybody's having to pay to watch in a Premier League and so on. But even so, we couldn't have anticipated the level of entertainment that the games continually produced on a match a night by night basis. It was a developing narrative, and I think people here in the UK and indeed throughout the world just became hooked on it as each evening seemed to provide some more sporting drama for us.
I mean, there's so many exciting moments. And for me, one of the amazing stats, obviously some of the big four, you know, Italy and, of course, Holland don't even make it to Russia. I think this is the first time since the inaugural tournament that, inclusive of those big two, Brazil and Germany aren't involved in a semi-final scenario. So new teams come to the fore. This very exciting Belgium team almost matured on the world stage. And for me, Clive, personally, I was so impressed by the efforts of, and also the kind of extra moments, not just on the pitch but off it, of the Japanese team. So refreshing.
Yeah, they could have very, very easily caused an upset, another upset. A lot of the games were very closely contested, and some of the giants that we lost along the way, you know, went out in games which could, you know, could easily have gone their way. So, yeah, there was I think we sometimes forget that the World Cup is a cup competition, and particularly once you come down to the knockout stages, even in the group phase to a degree, you've only got three games in order to, you know, establish yourselves in the competition, and you know that's why we love football, that's why we love sport, because you're never quite sure at the outset, you know, how a match is going to develop, and the tournament was full of surprises, not least England reaching the semi-finals. I don't think that Gareth Southgate thinks for one moment that we were the fourth best team at the tournament. But in cup football, you don't have to be in order to reach the semi-final, and it was a semi-final that England could just as easily have won as lost.
Clive, I'm so glad you brought that. Obviously, no discussion of this year's World Cup could go to pass without unpacking England. I've been massively impressed with Southgate. I was somewhat unsure about his stature, his gravitas, but he's totally won me over. Again, a great tournament. As you mentioned, there was very much in England that sensation of football's coming home and the UK literally united, which is wonderful. However, I just want to make one final point on this, and love to get your kind of take on it. As you yourself said just a moment ago, that was a semi-final winnable, and you know, they go a goal up. For me, there was this frustrating sense, which almost goes against everything Southgate seemed to be about, which is that England went into their shell and invited Croatia, a very talented Croatia team, forwards. I honestly believe if they'd have played a little bit more like they'd been accustomed to throughout the tournament, I think that was a semi-final that could well have been won. And then, as you know, it's a final, 90 minutes of football, and goodness me, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking could and shoulds. England played seven games at the tournament and won three of them, lost three and drew one, and you know, thankfully won a penalty competition. But in a sense, that was a draw. So, and one of the three games we won was, you know, it's against the Rose and Crown St Albans, really. I mean, pretty much where Panama were. So, and yet you look back on the games, particularly on the game that we lost in extra time to Croatia, and you know, two, maybe even 3-0 wouldn't have flattered England at half time. I've actually watched the match back. I mean, it's kind of part of my professional duty to listen back to what I've said and done, to what ITV have said and done, see if we can improve. But it's also an interesting exercise when England games are such a big part of our contract and therefore my work, mm-hmm. to review the games. And, you know, I saw an incident which very few of your listeners would even remember, where Raheem Sterling took the ball down the dead ball line after about an hour. Vida challenged him. And at the time, I thought it was a strange challenge and nobody really appealed. It was a penalty, Tony. Mm-hmm. It was a penalty. No doubt about that now in my mind, now I've seen it back. And, you know, but, those moments turn close games, and it was a close game. And I came home and, you know, people, even the next day, people say, oh, Modric, you know, we have... You know, Luka Modric didn't have a great game against. He did in the final, and I don't think I would disagree that he, with the judgment that he was certainly one, if not the player of the tournament. But it's easy to kind of fall into an analysis which you feel is almost foisted upon you [S2] Yeah. [S1] By the players. In many ways, Croatia exposed England down the flanks rather than where Rakitic and Modric were playing. The right back, who was ruled out of the game 2 days earlier with a knee problem, was outstanding. Perisic obviously had a wonderful game against us too. They scored a goal which might easily have been disallowed. The equalising goal could easily have been disallowed. And then John Stones, who I watched at the weekend and I heard pundits eulogising and mm-hmm. the great tournament that he had. You know, in different circumstances, he could have been pilloried, really, because it was one individual lapse which allowed Mandzukic in to score the goal, which at that stage was always going to decide it. But on balance, I can confirm everything that you saw about Gareth Southgate and liked about him is Gareth Southgate. That is not a front. That is the man. I've known him for many years. He worked on ITV. He was at my wedding, would you believe?
That's brilliant.
So I can tell you and your listeners that the Gareth Southgate that we all kind of fell in love with and all were impressed by is the real man. And in that sense, I think we're in good hands. I think we're a work in progress still. I think, in a curious way, three of the front four underperformed during the tournament, including Harry Kane.
Indeed.
You know, for whatever reason, Ali, Sterling and Kane, I don't think we quite got the... I think, and that's a veiled compliment, because I think they're all better than that.
Absolutely. I mean, the Harry Kane top scorer. I want to ask you this, when you look back and you unpack the games as you did there, looking at the Messrs. Kane, Ali, for you, do you think they were fully match fit in that semi-final?
Neither were half the Croatia players.
Yeah, true.
So, you know, what we did see was a World Cup which didn't suffer on the back of a long Western European club season. Somehow, the players found an energy and a passion to play for them. And they do play a little differently for the badges on their jerseys, I think, when they get international football. And one of Gareth's great triumphs was he got the England players to get what it meant playing for England. Maybe because he played for England and suffered himself, he was able to translate what we all felt. That this, I remember saying in the final friendly at Leeds, in the last 5 minutes, that I felt this would be an easy England team to support. And I think that's exactly what they were. We just kind of felt as if they were all on board with the rest of us, that there were no egos there. I mean, you know, let's face it, when you've got 27 million people watching a semi-final as watched that night, quite a lot of them would never really have heard of Kieran Trippier or Harry Maguire before the tournament. And yet these guys have come home, not quite national heroes, but, you know, guys that if you did bump into them in Sainsbury's, you'd go and give them a hug because you feel as if they gave their all for the country. And that's all we ask when the Test match is on, when the Rugby World Cup's on. It's all we'll ask, you know, when the Ryder Cup starts in a couple of weeks' time, and I know that's very dear to your neck of the woods.
It truly is.
We just want these guys to go and represent us, and that's what that England team did.
I was saying to Bob Mills from Talk Sport a few weeks ago on this kind of very theme, if you kind of compare and contrast from the ignominious defeat against Iceland in the Euros versus this very gallant, very, you know, we can unpack it all we want. At the end of the day, the effort, the ethos, the passion there, the playing for the badge were kind of exuded out of every member of that squad. It's a massive tribute to what Southgate's achieved in a very short space of time. And for me, whilst again wanting to kind of manage expectations, do sense a very burgeoning kind of team in progress there, which is, I think, nationally going to be exciting over the next few years.
I think you're right, but I don't want people to reinvent history. Roy Hodgson is a really, really good man. That was not an unhappy England squad in either of the two. He took them to three tournaments. He took one kind of at the last minute. But in 14 and 16, it was not. It was many of the same players, by the way.
Indeed.
And they were not an unhappy group. They were. If anybody suddenly thinks, they were full of cliques and Liverpool didn't talk to match, that was not the case in that England squad. And in many ways, the people who have suffered most from England's success are people like Roy and Ray Lewington and Gary Neville. They were doing... that Iceland game, I could watch a million times and never be able to explain to you why the players underperformed. It was not a lack of passion or not a lack of effort. They crumbled before our eyes. Now, maybe, if we had not equalised this time in the final minute of the opening game, maybe we'd come away and had 3 or 4 days of, wow, we can't even beat Tunisia, what chance have we got? Things did go for Gareth's team this time. It did kind of fall into place. Even the draw and, you know, the way that developed suddenly... We were facing a knockout stage where, you know, we were only having to beat Sweden and Croatia to get to the final. So a lot of things fell into play, as they did in the past for Sir Bobby Robson's teams. You know, a couple of things happened in 86 and 90, which just paved the way for them to go forward. It didn't happen for Roy in that sense. But don't ever allow yourself to feel... That same England squad under Roy Hodgson and Ray Lewington was full of misery and unhappiness and infighting. That wasn't the case.
Really appreciate you kind of setting the record straight there. For me, it was just a kind of comparison moment.
Yeah.
Again, the sense of, I wouldn't, as you say, again, not wanting to kind of reflect this onto Roy Hodgson, but just the sense of that was an England team wilting against, you know, Iceland. And in this England team, all the way through, again, as you say, many of the same faces, just seeming to fight to the death, which is, you know, just an interesting comparison.
Yeah.
Moving on super quick, Clive, just final quick question with regards to the World Cup. It's actually a technical one. I'm really fascinated to learn because obviously you are at the height of your profession. Again, when you are commentating on England, obviously you do have a certain duty to be objective, but it must be tricky when things are going so well and exciting and, again, when it flips the other way. How do you kind of keep a level head and keep an objective mindset in and amongst all this passion?
Well, I think I think objectivity is the key. I often refer to a match that the first England game I ever did live, and I had dear old Ron Atkinson alongside me. It was England-Scotland. It was the second leg of the playoff match for Euro 2000. And England won 2-0 in Glasgow, and Scotland came to Wembley really on a hiding to nothing. And Scotland outplayed England that night. They won 1-0, but England squeezed through. And 3 or 4 minutes into the commentary, Ron started saying, we've made a poor start here, we've made a slow start, they're playing better than we are. And I started to scribble notes to him, this is way back in 1999.
Indeed.
Saying, it's England, Scotland, not we, they. And he carried on with we and they. We got a half-time, of course we had a really good personal relationship, and he got quite ratty with me. He said, am I saying that we are playing well? And I said, no, you're saying we're playing rubbish, but you've got to call it England. He said, why? Everybody knows I'm English. I'm being objective. Of course I want us to win. Of course I want us to play well. But I'm still being objective. And from that day onwards, I thought, do you know what, Ron, you're right. And my greatest mentor in broadcasting, the late, great Reg Guttridge, always said to me, commentate to your audience. Don't try to commentate to the England manager or to, you know, some clever writer from The Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
Commentate to White Man, commentate to Taxi Driver, commentate to you and me, Tony, you know, and that's... And you and me were experiencing something during the World Cup, which was about we. It was about England and us and how we all felt. And you're not doing your duty as a commentator if you don't reflect some of that madness, some of that craziness, some of that passion and excitement that we saw in huge town squares with big screens reflected, which only football and only the World Cup can do. So, yeah, you've got to strike a balance. You've got to be objective. You've got to be able to say, you know, that was a poor pass. England have had a bad half, whatever. But at the same time, when... You know, when Kieran Trippier scores in the first few minutes of a World Cup semi-final, you've got to go crazy with the country. You've got to.
That sense of euphoria was brilliant. And again, I do believe there are certainly the shoots of something developing there under Southgate. But I could talk World Cup with you all day, but I very much appreciate your time. Just want to quickly bring it round to the Premier League, which obviously kicked off last weekend. One of the beauties of World Cup year is there's very little time between, the major action and then into domestic affairs. Again, Man U kick off strong. Man City looked imperious, I thought, against Arsenal. It's exciting early doors of the season where still every fan around the land still believes they can go all the way or maybe get a cup or some such. For you, Clive, based on what you've seen, who would your shout be for the Premier League? Is it Pep's to lose?
I think you've got to start with the team that set the standards the previous season. And the standard that they set was significantly better than anybody else. I mean, it's there in facts and figures, the number of points they achieved, the number of goals they scored, and so on. There is a big, big gap to close between first and second. They did it with the style, which was, you know, particularly pleasing on the eye. I think a word which... A word which is very difficult to define. It's a personal thing. Class.
Indeed.
They played with class, usually behaved with class. I mean, it's not something you necessarily associate with 21st century football, class. But there was a classiness about Manchester City, and I think there is about the whole setup. Of course, they've got barrel loads of money to spend. But they're not just spending it on players. They're spending on developing a part of Manchester which was in rack and ruin. They're building an academy there. They're building a community around the stadium. And these overseas investors who are always suspicious of have actually come in. And I think they have behaved with class since they came into the English game. And I think it's now reflected both in the way that Manchester City play and behave. And... you know, we're not named necessarily in the business of naming names, but you wouldn't have to travel too many miles away from Manchester City to find people behaving without any class. So, there's a lot of pressure and a lot of expectation on the major football clubs. But I think what we've seen in the opening weekend are two managers who behave in a way which connects with their football clubs, Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola. And obviously, I'm coming around to maybe suggest that Jose Mourinho isn't doing that at Manchester United at the moment. And that's what Gareth Southgate did. He connected with his football team and he connected with his public. And that's a really, really important part of football. Yeah, it's all about results. Yeah, it's a business to the people that work. It's their profession. And of course, they're not going to go around laughing and smiling every minute of the day. When the kind of online barracking and abuse that they suffer, the amount of scrutiny that they come under from the media. But if you can somehow catch the mood of what football is about, about the excitement and the joy that it brings to you and me and to White Van Man and the local taxi driver in St. Albans, if you can connect with some of that, just some of it, and retain your professional ability, then... You know, I think you're 90% of the way there. And I think both Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp, empowered by millions and millions of pounds of expenditure on good players. But nonetheless, I think they have connected with their public. And I think that's a really important part of football, and you'll get a little bit of leeway back, so that, you know, if they have a bad day or a bad result, their public will go with them. Even the media will go with them to a certain degree, and I think it's very important to bring that. And the signs of Bielsa starting to do that already. That connection is very, very important with the public.
You know, it really is. Just coming back to Man City and that brilliant kind of analysis there, that use of that almost indefinable quality, which is class. Something that is, I think, often forgotten about Manchester City, because, again, you look at their glittering kind of goal-scoring prowess, it's just the work rate that, Guardiola has instilled. From the strikers right to the back, every man is working when they don't have the ball, and they're working off the ball and making runs. This is a very, very kind of together team, and I definitely feel they are the ones to beat. Liverpool, as you say, through Klopp, spend big. I want to say this much on Klopp. Again, great run for them last season, of course, in the Champions League. Again, capturing the hearts and minds of so many here in the UK. But maybe Klopp has had a very intriguing run, maybe because of his charm you alluded to. But at the end of the day, at the moment, the trophy cabinet is still bare. I think perhaps for the first time this season, there is that need to get some trophy under his belt to build momentum. Of course, Ferguson's whole era began with a wonderful turnaround at Crystal Palace, which led to an FA Cup win. Again, with regards to Jose personally, I'm a big fan. I appreciate his character. Nevertheless, it doesn't always bathe him in glory. His, of course, great run began with a League Cup victory with Chelsea.
Yeah,
my point is,
a
silverware is necessary for Liverpool.
Yeah, the domestic cup competitions have obviously lost a little bit of their shine. When you're talking about Liverpool, they've had one decent domestic cup run under Klopp, and that actually can lift a lot of spirits when things aren't going as well as they may be doing, for instance, during a league campaign. And I think that is a bit of a need now for Liverpool. I think he's appreciative of that. They lost a rather bizarre FA Cup tie to West Bromwich Albion at Anfield last season when he did put out quite a strong team. And, I think he looks back on that match with particular regret. I think he recognises the need. He probably couldn't have envisaged the Champions League run that they would have at that stage of the season, in whenever it was, late January, early February. Mm-hmm. He couldn't have envisaged that they would go all the way in the Champions League. And that obviously helped keep Liverpool's season bubbling along. But yeah, I think the addition of a good domestic cup run would be a big boon for Liverpool, and they have a squad that's deep enough now to support campaigns on three or four different fronts. So yeah, I think that would be a big step forward, because it is going to be a huge gap for Liverpool or anybody to close in order to see Manchester City out over the course of a 38 game league season. But, if they can establish themselves in the Champions League and build on what they did last year and reach a domestic cup final, maybe win a domestic trophy, then I think that would be signs of real progress. And in fairness to Klopp, I understand what he's saying, but I think there have been signs of progress with each year. I think that's very, very important. And that's, that's a good sort of barometer of a judgment of a manager, particularly at a large club where there is an element of project about it.
Really well made points. A couple of final points really quickly. Again, at the other end of the scale, so much money, of course, has been spent in the transfer window. Always fascinating to see. Another man maybe need with certain expectations on his shoulders this season is Pochettino at Spurs. More Spurs players have played more minutes in the World Cup than any other team. Fascinating. But no summer signings. Were you surprised by that? And what would you think the Spurs fans will be hoping for this campaign?
I mean, I think that I know quite a lot of Tottenham fans, and they're a little fearful because they're not only have Spurs not become involved in the market in the summer just gone, they weren't particularly successful in the market last summer. That the incoming transfers to Tottenham haven't made quite the impact over the course of the last 18 months that probably they would have hoped, considering the progress that they've been making as a football team under Maurizio Pochettino. I mean, everything seems to gravitate back to dear old Gareth at the moment. I can tell you and your listeners that Gareth Southgate is a huge fan of Pochettino and the way he develops players. He likes the mentality of the Tottenham players that he inherits from Pochettino. He likes the relationship that he's got with him and with the football club. So I think he's still one of the very strongest suits at Tottenham, the manager. You know, I think that they should almost be as fearful of losing him as they, you know, maybe are of Kane or whoever. But there is, as you say now, particularly as they haven't had a real break, there is perhaps fear as to exactly where Kane and Ali will be in October, November without, you know, without a decent break and what the coaches call a proper pre-season. And Daniel Levy is a very, very shrewd man. What they do have this season, or will have quite soon, is the boost, I think, of an excellent new stadium. New stadia can be a mixed blessing.
Mm-hmm.
I think one or two clubs, and we can name them, West Ham United quite recently,
have struggled
really to make themselves at home in a new stadium. Everything I've seen of the new stadium up at White Hart Lane is that it's a proper high-sided football stadium with a really good atmosphere. It's on basically the same site as the old ground. So I think actually Spurs fans will see coming away from Wembley and coming back to the lane as being a bit of a boost. And providing they get a decent start there, I think the Tottenham players will get a little bit of a lift from coming back home. But yeah, a couple of new faces certainly wouldn't got a miss, particularly as there are no real shooting stars coming through from the youth ranks. I mean, we saw a little bit of Walker Peters the start of last season. The midfield player who played for England in the middle of the year and then had an injury problem. I mean, he might develop, but then there are no real shooting stars coming through from the youth. It looks like it's going to be basically the same team again. So
they will be a year older and a year wiser. So I guess that's their hopes.
Maybe a year wearier too.
True that. Final quick question, Clive, because you've been so generous with your time. I just want to quickly unpack your thoughts for Watford. Great result for them at the weekend in front of their home faithful. You know, Pereira gets his fifth goal in five matches in front of the home fans, so certainly becoming a fan favourite there. They spend 30 plus million this season. Again, Watford, fourth straight season in the big league, in the Premier League. So many clubs around the land would love to be in their situation. Where do you think they'll finish? And again, will Gracia be a manager for Watford come Christmas?
Well, with Watford's recent record, the answer is no. Almost whatever he does. I think it's very, very difficult to take a step back from your own family, your own radio station, your own football club, and look at it objectively. I mean, we are so emotionally, we're almost as emotionally involved with our own football club as we are with our, you know, with our own family, and consequently, it's difficult to be objective and reasoned. And sometimes you maybe need to listen to somebody who has taken a step back and is looking at it from the outside. Four seasons in a row in the Premier League, and no major relegation battle for a couple of seasons. That is massive progress for Watford. That is, you know, if you think back however many years it is now, 15, 20 years, that's kind of where they got to. You know, before they started to establish themselves, before they finished runners-up and so on. Yet you have to walk before you can run, and particularly when you're competing in a league where the top six places are probably pretty much cemented now in some order or another. So, you know, Watford are playing in a 14-team league, really. And if they can finish in the top three or four of that, it would be a massive achievement again. And, of course, the investment is considerable, but it's not considerable compared to some of the teams that are going to turn up to play at Watford this season who've invested that in a right back.
Indeed.
I mean,
goalkeepers these days are worth twice that spend, apparently.
And And why wouldn't you? You know, if you're Liverpool and you're generating the income that they are doing, and goalkeeper is such a yawning need for them, why wouldn't you go out and spend whatever it takes to get a goalkeeper of of real repute? Watford are just not in that position where, you know, they can replace to order. They've got to try to grow together, and all 14 of those teams that are going to start the Premier League season with something of a survival mentality. If somehow during the course of the season you can break that survival mentality and break out into the green pastures of mid-table again, where you can actually start to enjoy your football and enjoy the fact that Tottenham are coming to town, or Liverpool are coming to town, or Manchester City are coming to town, then I think that's real progress, and I think Watford season ticket holders are then getting real value for money. What you don't want to do, obviously, is get involved in a grim last 3 months of the season where every nil-nil is cheered to the rafters. And Watford have avoided that for a little while now. So let's hope that that can happen again.
Yeah, that MO seems to be get to 40 and almost beach time. But like I say, four straight year in the Premier League. There are so many clubs up and down the land who would be so envious of that. Massive respect to Watford. We'll be following them all season. Clive, really, really appreciate your time. It's just been insightful as per standard. Have yourself a jolly good rest of the day and enjoy the Premier League season.
Thank you very much indeed, Tony. And all the best to Watford and all your listeners.
You're a scholar, gentlemen. Much obliged to you.